The real secret. The universe doesn't give a fuck about you. It may not sound like it, but this is good news. The universe doesn't give a fuck about you, not because you're not worthy or are out of alignment with the cosmos or have been put under a curse for 10 generations. No, the universe doesn't give a fuck about you because it has no fucks to give. Many of us are taught to spit. These guys are laughing.
We're holding it in. We're holding it in.
Release yourself. I want you to have an orgasm.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Mindful Conversations. My name's Shamash, and as usual, I'm with my friend
Calvin.
And today we have two special guests and two special friends, Dr. James Doty and Alex Nunn. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Yeah, exciting to be here.
Yeah, we're going to actually be talking today about all kinds of things. We're going to be talking a little bit about AI and happiness. But me and Shamash thought we'll have a conversation rather than an interview, because we already started the conversation. It's been going really well, and we want to continue that.
Amazingly, we've been getting on quite well. So.
What a shock.
Maybe if you could introduce yourselves. Alex, do you want to start?
Well, I think part of the reason I am here is because I know you a little bit, Shamash, because we've both been involved in an organization called Action for Happiness, which has been going now for about 12 years, which is a movement of people trying to create a happier and more caring society by taking actions in their lives that promote those qualities. So I'm really excited to be having this conversation with all of you today, and particularly also because I know Jim a little bit from having done the applied compassion training at the wonderful institution that he set up. So, yeah, excited to dive into the topic of compassion.
So my name is Jim Doty. I am a neurosurgeon at Stanford, although recently retired, and I founded and direct the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Training at Stanford, which is part of the School of Medicine. And that is one of the courses that we have, which Alex alluded to, Applied Compassion Training. Additionally, we do fundamental research on compassion. And in fact, our team developed a textbook, which Oxford University Press published, called the Oxford Handbook of Compassion Science. Additionally, I recently founded a company called Happy, HAPPI.AI, which has developed a unique app for supporting individuals' mental health, primarily focused on anxiety and stress, which uses artificial intelligence, a human-like avatar, as well as emotion assessment. And I also am the author of a book, which some of you may have read. It was a New York Times bestseller. It's in 36 languages, and it's called Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. I also have a new book coming out in May of next year called Mind Magic, The Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything. In fact, I think Shamash either will or may have me read the first paragraph or lines of that book.
I think that would be quite fun, actually.
But yeah, before we kind of get into that book, there's a connection between you, Alex, and Jim, and you did this compassion training. So why are we interested in doing this compassion training? Can you say a little bit about this compassion training you did with the Center for Compassion in Stanford?
Yeah, I can get to that, but I think in order to explain that, I kind of need to explain a little bit about who I am, really.
Please.
I'm someone that grew up in a situation, in global terms, of quite a lot of privilege. You know, I grew up in southwest London, lots of lovely houses around. It's kind of a beautiful place to be. But I also grew up in circumstances where I was being raised by a single parent who didn't have very much money at all. Mm. And I think what that meant for me is that I've grown up with a natural sensitivity to injustice, of feeling that things aren't quite right in the world. And the more that I've grown conscious of the state of the world, the more that injustice is apparent. So in terms of my personal journey, it's really got kind of two strains to it. One, which is, how do I take care of my own mental health and well-being in the context of a profoundly unwell society? And then also, what are the actions that I can take that bring about some kind of meaningful change? Mm. And it's been through this, exploring both those paths, that's taken me through spaces like Buddhism and visiting places like Plum Village and Thich Nhat Hanh, And then also working as an activist in many different organizations, including sort of Free Tibet and youth politics stuff, to land where I am today, which is this organization, Action for Happiness. But as I've walked that dual path, for me, compassion has been the sort of place that I've landed where I'm like, ah, this is kind of it. This is the answer to both those questions. This is how I can take care of myself in the context of an unwell world. And this is how I can take meaningful action that's going to bring about significant change. So then I started scrabbling about looking for like, okay, so where do you learn about compassion? Like what sources are there? Because you can go the kind of Buddhist route and look at some of this ancient stuff, but you've really got to learn a lot of historical context and find a route into that as a Westerner, sort of secular, skeptical Westerner. Accessing that can be quite difficult. And in terms of secular education on compassion, there really isn't anywhere better than CCARE. Like you guys were the sort of founding kind of architects of so much that's been out there in the world on this topic, whether it's the kind of Oxford handbook that Jim edited and put together, or things like the compassion trainings that have come out of Stanford too. I was very, very lucky, I think, because of the kind of speakers we've had to find out about those things. And I think part of why I was attracted to applied compassion training is because the idea of how we take this knowledge and really apply it in the world was very meaningful to me. And I'm proud to be a compassion ambassador.
Wow. You mentioned compassion a few times, and Jim, you started the Center for Compassion. Could you start by defining what the word compassion means to you, and a little bit about the story about how you ended up starting this organization, CCARE?
Sure. So it is important, especially if you're a scientist, that you have your terms defined. And the reality is that many people confuse the term empathy with compassion. And the difference is that empathy implies taking on the emotional state of another. You don't have to be suffering necessarily at all. In fact, you can have empathic joy. And so this is where people get confused. Plus, the reality is empathy has no action component. That being said, compassion means the recognition of another's suffering with a motivational desire to alleviate that suffering. That also implies, while you may have the desire, you may not actually be able to help, but you want to help. The other aspect, of course, is that compassion implies action. So those are the differences. And then, of course, you have other terminology which gets thrown in the mix, which is pity and sympathy. And pity is, in some ways, looking above it all in an elevated state where, on a cognitive level, you see somebody suffering, perhaps, but you have no real connection and you are looking at it as if you're superior to them. Therefore, you feel pity on them. And compassion requires you to look eye to eye with them. And those are two significant differences. Sympathy is a cognitive understanding, but it's not necessarily you're connected to that suffering.
So compassion kind of involves this action. Now, I know a lot of our kind of followers are into meditation and mindfulness and compassion practices too. So this may be an open question for everyone. But something like a loving kindness practice or a compassion practice, would you say then that is compassion, or is that just preparing the brain for compassion? It's not actually compassion.
I mean, certainly it puts it at both cognitive and emotional level, and perhaps it makes you understand it, but it's not necessarily compassion itself, unless you then go the next level and say, the nature of my doing this practice allows me to have self-compassion. Okay. And then, as many of your listeners know, so many of us today in modern society, we beat ourselves up more than anyone else does. And it's really unfortunate. Now we can go into the evolutionary constructs of that. But that being said, what is interesting about self-compassion is the reality that if you're not kind to yourself, the lens through which you're looking at the world is distorted because you're carrying the baggage of, if you will, being mean to yourself or being unkind to yourself. And then it makes you look out of that lens, with this attitude that that is people don't deserve compassion. They don't deserve kindness. It makes it much harder to connect. When you're kind to yourself and you are able to give yourself positive self-affirmation, then it makes you change your outlook to one of common humanity and actually connecting with the other. And at its highest level, of course, that's seeing the other as yourself. And if you're able to get to that point, you know, that's an extraordinary accomplishment, because then, frankly, that is what defines, in some ways, ethics and morality, because if you see this other as yourself, you would never do anything to hurt that person.
What do you think, Alex?
I'm remembering that Jim introduced this idea of the difference between empathy and compassion, and I think that's a really useful thing to unpack a little bit more. I think one of the things that brought me to compassion was recognizing that there's so much suffering in the world, and the way that our society primarily conditions us to deal with that is through avoidant and suppressive mechanisms. We either intellectualize it or we avoid thinking about it entirely. We have these kind of pleasure-seeking consumerist mechanisms for not addressing things. And I think that's partly it's a sort of foolish wisdom. It's because we're recognizing at some level that the empathic impact of connecting to that suffering could potentially overwhelm us psychologically and burn us out. And people have misunderstood that to be a kind of compassion fatigue, which I'm aware Tanya Singer was really effective for me in turning this around to reframe that not as compassion fatigue, but as empathic distress fatigue, because actually compassion does not have a fatiguing effect. The thing that's really exciting, and I can feel my skin slightly tingling as I mentioned this, what's really exciting about compassion is that when you're able to actually be in touch with the suffering, rather than being depleted or overwhelmed by it, something arises in us. A kind of sense of empowered agency kind of flows into our system. It's been a completely necessary part of our psychology for survival. It's the reason why, you know, mothers can do incredible feats to protect their children, or why a soldier might throw themselves on a grenade to protect their kind of fellow team members. You know, we have this natural capacity for incredible courage, incredible action. But the fuel for that is this kind of compassionate response, which we're actually societally quite blocked from. We're not being given the tools to cultivate and to engender that. And so I think mindfulness is a really interesting sort of supportive quality, because the more that we're able to gain a sense of perspective towards things, the more likely we are to leave space for a compassionate response to arise to our awareness of suffering.
What do you think about that, Carl?
Well, I mean, I was grateful for Jim's separation of empathy and compassion. I was thinking about this recently in the context of a lot of the conversations that are happening in the world now, and whether compassion is at risk, whether the economic situation, the technological situation, the evolution has a potential to downplay people's wanting or desire to reduce the suffering of others. So I just wonder whether where we are now and this technological impetus, how do you think that's going to affect the way people show up in compassion, especially in the context of technology can help with that? And you talk about happy.ai.
Oh, that's a question for me. Well, I think there are several issues here that maybe need to be unpacked as well. And if you look at these blue zones, which are part of the world where people routinely live to be over 100, and you'll hear, well, I have this new Mediterranean diet cookbook, right? The reality is, while diet is important, while exercise is important, while not smoking is important, while eating moderately is important, if you look at the statistics, by far and away, is the reality that what allows us to live a long time is how connecting with others and having deep relationships, which generally are imbued with compassion, affect you mentally and physically in a very positive way and increase your longevity. And what has happened, and you know, there are only five blue zones in the world left, right? What has happened is, as we have become a quote-unquote modern society, unlike the blue zones where you have family members live together, you have children, you have grandchildren, you have parents, you have grandparents, either living in the same household or in close proximity. You were born there, you die there, everyone knows you. And the thing is, everyone knows you and they know the good parts and the bad parts, but regardless, they still love you. And this love and unconditional acceptance is really, really critical. And unfortunately, as we've become a quote-unquote modern society, and I certainly wouldn't say a better society, what has happened is that you don't live with any family members. Often you're separated by thousands of miles. You now have jobs, which for many people are highly stressful, especially if you have nobody to share that with. And as a result of not having people who unconditionally accept you, you are incredibly anxious about being judged. And sort of this is a toxic combination that impairs one's ability to be compassionate. Because what happens is, if you have fear and anxiety, then you've now engaged your sympathetic nervous system. When you engage your sympathetic nervous system, what happens is that the executive control areas in your brain are impaired. So you don't have access to memory and experience to make wise decisions. You're reactive. And then this has a negative physiologic effect on your heart, your blood pressure, your immune system. It stimulates the production of inflammatory proteins. It increases your stress hormone levels. So it has a huge negative consequence. And further data that supports this is a study that was done at Harvard over 80 years where they followed a group of individuals. And again, it showed the exact same thing. The longevity, the health, almost always related to depth of relationships. So this is really an important and a critical part. And so we have to create a situation where people can be comfortable with themselves and frankly accept the fact that you're not perfect and that's okay, instead of trying to give others this image that you are perfect. And unfortunately, the bad part of social media is that what it does is it actually separates you. Because there are all these people who are giving an image of perfection when, of course, they're not perfect. And then for that subset of individuals, many of them commit suicide because they're living a lie between what they're trying to present and what they are. But sadly, the nature of what these people are doing also has a negative influence on people because they believe that that is the way you should be. And obviously, it's not. Every one of us is a frail, fragile human being. Most people are just trying to get by. And actually, all most people want is just to be accepted and loved.
Alex, you work at this charity, Action for Happiness, and it touches the lives of millions of people. And you're obviously very passionate about compassion. And I've noticed in the materials you talk about kindness and compassion. So what is your charity doing to help kind of move people towards cultivating maybe more of this self-compassion that Jim was talking about to suit themselves, and also spreading more compassion, hopefully, to the world?
Yeah. I'm hesitating because I'm wondering if I'm about to kind of blow the lid on a kind of... One of the things that's kind of exciting about Action for Happiness is actually quite subversive. It has quite an unexpected effect. It turns out that you don't need to tell people what to do in order to help move them along a path that gets them where you want them to go. Mm. Actually, one of the reasons why I've stayed working in an organization that's got happiness in the title, when I really care about compassion and kind of social systems and social justice.
Compassion was taken.
Is because actually when you ask people to reflect on where happiness really comes from in their lives, they all come to the same kind of conclusions quite quickly. The importance of other people, the like unimportance of a lot of material conditions after, you know, certain basic needs are met. You know, this is kind of intrinsic to human nature. So actually by helping spark people to reach for something that they know that they want, which is happiness, we're setting up the conditions whereby they can actually discover the things that create that happiness, which turn out to be exactly kind of co-arising with compassion. So that's a lot of where it comes from. Of course, the organization itself is structured in a way that has a very wide funnel. We're promoting a lot of different ideas around resilience, around gratitude, around how exercising and taking care of your body. There's so many different factors that go into kind of what makes for a happy life. But that the nature of engaging with our organization is that you then meet and connect with other people who are also on a similar journey. And the bonding that happens as you go through one of our courses or groups, for example, where you're actually having these much deeper experiences of sharing with other human beings, naturally educate people on what really matters in life and kind of how they can connect in more deeply and embed those practices more deeply in their own lives. So it's got quite a subtle journey, but one that leads to quite an interesting place. And when we measure outcomes, you know, sort of compassion, we use sort of Santa Barbara measures of compassion to measure our kind of pre-post results in our courses and things. We see a lot of those and social trust and other measures going along with things like life satisfaction that we measure, which is really incredible to see, actually, that you're able to produce these changes in how people relate to one another, not only how they relate to themselves, even though you've acquired them through a route where they were primarily self-interested in why they reached out to in the first place. So there we go. Don't tell anyone.
The secret.
Yeah, the secret.
So something very interesting about, you know, compassion coming up a lot in this series, you know, one of the first questions Shamash and I had was, well, now technology, AI, everybody's been talking about this. Is this really an invitation to question what it really means to be human and to live fuller human lives? Or is that just hyperbole? You know, are people really just overreacting to AI? Does this technology have, is there an opportunity here for us to discover a more compassionate society through the technological evolution that's happening, or revolution? How do you see that playing out?
I think that's a good question. And it is interesting because in some ways there's a lot of hyperbole around AI. And in fact, if you see all these startups or advertisements, every one of them says, you know, we've incorporated AI into this, this, and this. And frankly, a lot of that is very misleading. You ask about AI sort of becoming human or sentient, if you want to use that term. And the reality is AI is not human. It can imitate human behavior and through immense volumes of data acquisition, it can try to understand what a human is and have that sort of interaction. But fundamentally, it will not be human. Now, does that negate the fact that it could be potentially very useful? No. But you have to recognize it for what it is. One of the problems, though, is that the need for all of us to be accepted and cared for can lead people down a path where that need then has them connecting in a very, very deep way that in some ways could be potentially pathologic. As an example, we talked about happy.ai. What we have done is we have an emotion engine, which we developed, which assesses your emotional state throughout the interaction. It's connected to a proprietary conversational AI knowledge base that includes psychology and compassion-focused therapy, and then it's connected to a very, very lifelike human avatar. And the great thing is that the conversation, and this is about supporting your mental health, can be extraordinarily powerful and can put you back on the right track. But in the wrong circumstances, you could see how potentially someone who may have a very specific profit motive can then use it to manipulate people and manipulate their emotions, even to an addictive level. And, you know, we have the movie She, and then we have Ex Machina. Machina. I'm sorry about my Latin. And they show some of the dangerous sides of this. But, you know, if you're upfront about what you're trying to do with this technology and everyone is aware of it and you have these cautionary aspects of it, well, I think it can do extraordinary things. And even in the work that we've done before we launched this app, it's amazing how people have connected. They feel like they're not being judged. They feel as if the conversation is one of empathy and compassion. And the great thing is that, you know, it's available 24/7. And, you know, as many who may be listening who see therapists, you know, you see them once a week. Well, if it's midnight and on Sunday and there's no therapist available, or you try to call them, and of course, what do they say? They say, if this is a life-threatening emergency, please call. Yeah. And this is not particularly soothing. It's primarily for medical legal coverage. But having someone to talk to when you're at your lowest moments, and it is empathic and compassionate and non-judgmental, it's very, very powerful.
What do you think about it, Alex, about the whole AI, and do you think it can help spread more compassion in the world?
Well, I'm glad that Jim's given an example of like a positive intervention, because I'm aware of the kind of negativity bias in all of our minds to like highlight problems and to potentially to exaggerate those, though I don't want to diminish them. I do also think there is a reality of change going on. You know, we have this accelerating changes in technology. We have climate change. We have various kind of things happening at the geopolitical level that are extremely disruptive. And I think one of the challenges for us is to work out how we as individuals and collectively respond to change as a whole. Because our political systems are incredibly slow to change, very difficult to influence, unlikely to be the bearers of solutions to these grand problems. And I think one of the things that gives me courage, one of the areas I look at for inspiration is, you know, you're a mindfulness teacher, Shamash, and one of the ways to conceive of mindfulness is moving from a state of reactivity to a state of kind of responsiveness. We have this capacity to open up space in ourselves to see things as they really are, and to allow kind of more creative, more visionary, more kind of fresh ideas to kind of come into the system. So what I really feel, whatever the change we're talking about, whether it's AI or any of these other changes, what I really feel we can offer in the kind of more in the well-being psychology space is the opportunity for a kind of collective awakening to spread the skills that do raise levels of happiness and well-being, do raise compassion. But these things are co-emergent with wisdom. And that wisdom, drawing on this kind of vast resources that we leave mostly untapped in ourselves, could bring in these kind of outliers, the sort of black swans kind of dynamics that may bring very different opportunities to the table than we're currently conceiving.
And that gets back to the nature of AI, because it can scour through immense amounts of data and get insights which are not readily available. And you can learn incredible things. And this is in some reasons why this is being used in medicine, because it can vastly accelerate knowledge. But again, like any technology, there are good aspects and there are negative aspects. You know, we're talking about mental health apps. You can imagine that some people, and it's already happening, where they use AI in a way to manipulate people, as an example, to create artificial relationships and then have them, let's say, spend money, do all of these things. But the reality is that is the nature of human existence. You have probably 5% of people who will violate any trust or do anything to take. But the vast, vast majority of people are actually people who love and care and give. But we have to be cognizant of the fact that there's a subset of people who will continually, if you want to say, violate the rules, and that's just reality. Thus, we have to still maintain our vigilance about these technologies, and specifically about AI.
AI and machine learning is being used in social media for years, I would say, and they're kind of optimizing for maximizing profit and use of attention. So something really exciting about your technology, Jim, and others like you, is that you're using machine learning and AI, but you're plugging it in with the wisdom traditions, compassion-focused therapy. So if we connect AI with something like that, you know, maybe there's a potential where that could spread compassion in a rapid way, just as social media did in a negative way.
Well, you have to understand that, at least in the United States, 25% of people will tell you that they have absolutely no one to talk to when they're suffering.
Yeah.
You know, the average male has 0.6 friends, and it's hard to talk to a 0.6 person. But But my point is that there is an immense amount of suffering because of the reality of these situations. And as we're talking about, many, many people are terrified. And in fact, there's some cultures, whether it's Middle Eastern or Asian, we're talking about mental health or some of the struggles you're having are taboo to talk about. So by having a human-like avatar who you connect with can express your feelings and feel that you're being heard, even though you know it's an avatar, can actually be incredibly soothing and helpful for a lot of people. So I think there are some extraordinarily powerful upsides of these types of technologies. You know, it's interesting, you mentioned some of these social media companies. I mean, they employ neuroscientists, psychologists to provide you with drips of dopamine to keep you addicted to these events. And it's funny, one of the major technology companies who recently changed their name, but I won't say who they are. I actually went to them and I said, you know, it's extraordinary because you have, you know, millions and millions of people. You can actually do these micro studies to see how powerful interventions can be. And in fact, we did this with some types of compassion interventions in people who posted stuff that the person who they were posting about felt very negative, and it sort of promoted compassionate conversation to resolve these issues. But what I said was, you know, there are all these hotspots around the world, and frankly, these social media companies have immediate access to that information. I said, why don't you take that and that information and then start promoting positive stories? So if there's a conflict, you populate the whole thing with stories about working together, cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. And so we started moving down that path, and then unfortunately, that person left the company.
Did they become like an ex-CEO?
it was not the CEO, but I'm sure that. So then the new person said, we're not interested in doing that, which is really unfortunate. I mean, can you imagine the power that you potentially have to present conflict, to prevent conflicts in the world by your data, yet you would rather have conflict because that promotes expenditure of dollars?
That's an interesting question. And this keeps coming back to this thing about motivation. You know, Shamash mentioned profit, and you talked about, you know, some people being interested or not, and this kind of motivation, like why would somebody want to use it in this way versus that way, or in a positive way versus a destructive way, or constructive versus destructive? I just want to actually connect back to something that we, Shamash and I, were walking around San Diego and San Francisco around the Wisdom Conference. Oh, hey, what do you think it means to be human? You know, we're talking about all this AI stuff. What do you mean? And all these words came up. Compassion was a big one. Community was another one. Creativity was another. We ended up calling them the seven C's, right?
Yeah.
And then it just got more. I think we had eight, then we had 10. But seven C's sounds good. And so I'm just wondering, let's say I'm using Happy AI or some other AI technology to help myself befriend somebody, experience self-compassion. Do you think that will then maybe open the door to other C's of the seven C's? Might I want to venture out and connect or with community thereafter, or, you know, and be more curious about getting into creativity? Or how does that all connect to the next step?
Well, looking at Action for Happiness as a kind of case study for this, we've kind of built that funnel into our system. So in Action for Happiness, we've got a number of resources that we share with people. One of them is like a daily action calendar for each month. So for example, this month is Optimistic October, and there's little things you can do each day.
Yeah.
And those kind of continue throughout the year. Those are accessed by, say, like 50 million people who download those and use those. And we see them in the backgrounds of like Louis Theroux documentaries on like a wall in like the NHS. That's a really nice feature of the world. We're like, oh, our work is reaching people. But the like scope for human connection out of those is pretty limited. Like, unless someone's actually implementing the actions on those, it's kind of just like a nice thing, nice sort of entity to have and stick up on a wall. But through those, people often then join our community. They find out about the webinars we do with great speakers, like hopefully Jim next year.
Maybe.
we got a few minutes left. But people kind of come in through those. And then the webinars are really interesting because people turn up for like a speaker. They want to have this access to this knowledge. And they think they're doing that for very kind of like one-to-one relationship kind of basis.
Yeah.
What they find is that in the chat, they see so much sharing and connection and people being supportive to one another. They start to kind of get excited and interested in this community at large. And we then have various ways in which we continue to give them things they can implement on their own, but that lay this kind of breadcrumb path of them getting more and more involved with other people. And so certainly we see this transition journey of people coming into this because they care about their own happiness and well-being, and they want to find resources that work for them. And we just give them exactly what they need. But we let those people discover that there's the opportunity for more connection as they find that. It's a natural flow. People get drawn in to greater senses of connection. I think that when I think about technology, that's really the part of it that feels optimistic for me, is the opportunities created for new organizations and connection, because we have this opportunity to tune into the needs and interests of people vastly distributed across the world. Our previous like scope of potential connection was limited by geography. It's like, where can you travel to and who's in that place?
Yeah.
Like, that's what you've got. As soon as the internet was kind of released en masse, you then have this ability to connect with fans of this obscure band that you think only you love. And then it turns out there's thousands of other people around the world. You've now got the ability to connect with and to have relationships with. I think the challenge for us is, how do we reapply those new connections back in the real world? What's the link between these distributed online communities and the kind of real world connection that we really need to sustain us? And how do we get to the point that we've able to connect as broadly as possible through technology, but then still have those connections Jim was talking about in the blue zone, where you have this unconditional positive regard that lasts in a multi-generational way and is the foundation for our own kind of self-acceptance and the love that we all need to live on?
Love that answer. And it's making me wonder, actually, talk about its distribution. So, you know, we got fed up of walking. And so we started riding horses, right? And we got cars, you know. We got fed up of, you know, talking, so we started using WhatsApp. We got fed up of thinking, we started using AI. Do we need to apply this in the real world? Or could we just let our avatars do everything?
You're insane. No. Well, look, there is a natural progression of technology, which in some ways you've just described. But at some point, we are still living human, sentient beings. And at some point, you give up that. And frankly, there may be no reason to live even, right? What makes living enjoyable in many ways is accepting the reality that the nature of life is suffering, but actually accepting the suffering because you're on a journey and other people are with you on the journey supporting you. And that's how the nature of our humanity has evolved. And so, first of all, if everybody had everything, then suddenly you are unhappy about everything. And this is sadly some of this reality of people who have unlimited resources, financial resources. You can go anywhere you want. You can live wherever you want. You can buy the biggest mansion, every car you want. And as you probably know, many of these people are incredibly unhappy. They have everything, but they're unhappy. Then you go, let's say, to a village in Vietnam or in some Eastern culture, and you see people who are living extraordinarily humbly. And, you know, you see a child ecstatic because somebody gave him a piece of gum, right? And so having the still joy and about sort of things that aren't really available to you is in some ways part of being happy versus, I'm sure you've run across people who are extraordinarily wealthy, have access to everything, and the whole interaction is just one of boredom when you interact with them. And unfortunately, entitlement oftentimes. And it's a sad thing to watch because they're so bored, they just go around doing stuff that's useless because they're trying to find something that will fill that empty void. What they don't understand is the only thing that fills that void frankly, is being of service to other people. That is what will make you happy. And of course, we know the Dalai Lama has said, what is it? If you want to make other people happy, you know, be compassionate. If you want to be happy, be compassionate. And it's the only time he says it's okay to be selfish, because when you're doing service for other people, you are actually incredibly benefiting. Mm-hmm. And what the subset of people I was just describing to you, they keep splurging on themselves and they get nothing out of it. It's like being on a diet which has no nutrient value versus doing little acts of kindness towards others. You can be the most joyful, happy person. And it, frankly, it doesn't cost very much at all.
Yeah.
I think what the question leaves out is a fact about what it means to be a human being. A human being is a combination of a mind and a body. And yet, because of a lot of the way that we have conversation, the way that we interact with technology, we've come to be very mind-biased. We've got a very cognitive-biased conception of who we are, what identity is, how we exist in the world, and the body gets basically forgotten. Whereas when you start to practice mindfulness, when you start to look at what really makes you happy, you realize that the body is actually pretty fundamentally important. You can't just sit there for 6 hours a day scrolling through Instagram reels and come out of it feeling healthy, happy, and wise. Like, believe me, I've tried. I keep trying. It doesn't get you anywhere. And when we tune into the body, we recognize that we are physically present in the world at all times, and that that body is materially reliant on the works of other people. Other people grow my food. Other people build the buildings we're sitting in. Other people are fundamentally necessary to my continued existence. So I think at any point that we start to build more and more technological reasons and to have a mind further and further away from the body, there will be a counter swing where the body will resurge and we'll have to come back to it. So I think it's unlikely to ever be fully replaced.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
We've been talking about kind of transformation, societal transformation, and that links to potentially personal transformation. And one way of describing that transformation is manifestation. And Jim, I know that you've been writing a book on this topic, and there's all sorts of books out there, and some would call it pseudoscience on manifesting and creating this kind of transformation. What kind of motivated you to write this book called Mind Magic, Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything?
Well, thanks for asking that question. I'm glad you're promoting my happy app, my book. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, have either heard of or have read a book called The Secret. And in fact, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, The Secret has sold 37 million copies, so it's no secret. But the unfortunate thing about The Secret, which I found actually personally offensive, is the fact that it focuses on me. I want, you know, I need a Ferrari, I need a big house, I need to have an X job, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with that is that it goes against every principle in terms of how a person becomes happy. And what I mean by that is that happiness, meaning, purpose, aren't about you. They are, and again, this is how we evolved as a species. We're one of the few species where our offspring don't run off into the forest or the jungle or swim away. We have to care for them for literally years and years until they're 13, 14, 15, even longer. And as a result, we have to attend to their needs, whether that need is food or clothing, or they bump their knee and they're in pain, whatever it is, we have to be there for them or they will not survive, nor will our species survive. So as a result, we have these inherent, deeply ingrained mechanisms in which we are rewarded when we care. Thus, if a mother cares for her offspring, she is rewarded by her pleasure and reward centers being stimulated by these actions of caring. And as a result, it also shifts you into your engagement of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is that state, which is the opposite of stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, the stress, the fear, whatever mode, to one of often called rest and digest. But what happens when you're in that mode, when you're caring, when you're open, when you're loving, your physiology works its best. Your heart functions better. There's something the listeners may have heard of called heart rate variability. When you have actually a decrease in heart rate variability,
increase is good.
And when you have a decrease, that means your sympathetic nervous system is engaged. When you have an increase, actually, which seems paradoxical, actually your physiology is working at its best. And in fact, when you have a decrease in heart rate variability, that is when you have the highest incidence of sudden cardiac death. But your blood pressure lowers, your immune system's boosted, your cortisol levels go down. This is where you're meant to live. And in fact, from a brain perspective, you're much more creative, you're much more productive. And again, your reward centers have been stimulated. So thus, this is why it's important that we actually care and connect. That is when we function our best. That's when we care the most. That's when the most people benefit. So this idea of the secret, focusing on self, not only is it destructive in terms of your mental state, making you narcissistic, and but it also is bad for you simply in regard to your own physiology. And you miss so much, because when you care for others, you get all the other stuff if you want it by being focused on others versus giving people nothing and focusing on yourself. And that is a very short-lived stimulant. This is the difference between hedonic happiness, if you will, which is the selfish happiness, which fundamentally is what The Secret is about, versus eudaimonic happiness, where you're benefiting from being of service, of caring. And this is what fulfills you. And this is what gives you happiness. It gives you joy. It gives you purpose and meaning. And so I hope that this book serves as demonstrating, if you will, the value proposition of looking at manifestation from the perspective of the other and not just focused on yourself.
Beautiful. Do you have any questions?
I'd like to buy the book.
Where can we buy the book?
We can make it manifest.
In the UK, the book will be released May 9th. You can pre-order it at any of your bookstores today.
May the 9th. So not May the 4th be with you, but May the 9th be with you.
Exactly.
Should we finish by you reading the introduction to the book? Because we quite enjoyed it.
This is the first audiobook preview on Mindful Conversations.
So Mind Magic, introduction, the real secret. The universe doesn't give a fuck about you. It may not sound like it, but this is good news. The universe doesn't give a fuck about you, not because you're not worthy or are out of alignment with the cosmos or have been put under a curse for 10 generations. No, the universe doesn't give a fuck about you because it has no fucks to give. Many of us are taught to spit. These guys are laughing.
We're holding it in.
Release yourself. I want you to have an orgasm. Many of us are taught to spend our lives hoping for something outside of ourselves to fix our problems and make us whole. A winning lottery ticket, a wise guide who knows all the answers, a guru, a guardian angel, or some magical being, force, energy, or genie sitting out there in the universe who will make everything work out for us. For years, I longed to believe this. Two, but I thought that there was some stern cosmic parent tracking all of my actions and deciding if we were worthy to receive our dream house or to meet our soulmate or to be cured of cancer. As a neuroscientist and physician, I know today that we have no proof of such a force or being, but we have a great deal of scientific evidence of the power of our own minds to produce changes in our lives that may at first appear impossible. This is the practice of manifestation.
Wonderful. So that book's going to be coming out in May 2024. And in the US, when will it be out?
May 7th.
Okay, so you get it a couple of days.
So all of those who buy a book right now, I'll sign it for you.
Boom.
And will you go to each person's house? Or?
We're all going to meet on an island. I'm sending my private jet to pick everyone up, and we're just going to party. And at the end of it, the universe will give a fuck about it. Actually, I'm being facetious, so I don't want anybody to sue me. Although, I will sign your book if you track me down.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think what I really love in what Jim's shared there and what you're calling out, particularly with this kind of the wonderful capacity of laughter, is that often we're recognizing a truth that was difficult for us to hold onto without some kind of physical expression. And actually, I think this is very important work. We are living in a world in which right now there is a war raging in Ukraine, in which there's a conflict between people in Israel and people in Gaza, in which the climate situation is getting worse and worse and worse, and the response to it seems to be slowing down rather than speeding up. So the question for each of us of where do we find our faith, our confidence, our compassionate spirit to continue is actually really important. And pointing out the kind of ways in which our mind wants to find easy answers to that, but that actually don't satisfy us. Things like the social media, the avoidance strategies, these might work for a time, but they're ultimately, you know, a fool's errand. The mission that we have as people that care about mindfulness, that care about compassion, that are in the well-being movement, is to support our own well-being sufficiently that we're able to spread, support, and connect with others in a way that contributes to a collective awakening. So thank you for all being part of that.
Wow.
What a downer, man.
You're laughing, so that must be a truth.
I've enjoyed this conversation. I've learned more about what it means to be human. We've got the embodied part. You know, we've got all the insights and wisdom from Jim. I mean, what more could we want in our lives? We've won the lottery here.
Yeah, true. A book that comes out of medicine.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. It's been thank you, Alex, for making this physical space available in London so that we were able to have this conversation. Thank you, Jim, for giving your precious time to us so that we could learn more about the stuff that you're up to. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
And it is very precious time.
Thank you so much. Thank you. If you have any comments for Jim and you want to sign your book and track him down online, if you want to contact Action for Happiness, then feel free to reach out to them online as well, Action for Happiness, and ask us a question. Contact me and Shamash in the usual way. And that's it for now. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our latest episode of Mindful Conversations. If you liked what you heard, then please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, subscribe, share this with someone who you think would enjoy the show. And if you have any questions for us or comments, email us at connect@mindfulcombo.com. Bye for now.